Hello, hello, hello. Sorry for the delay. A little bit of technical difficulties for our friends out there in Streamland. I hope you can hear me. And I'd like to welcome you all to our first in a series of events about the Cyber Resilience Act. We have a wonderful little panel for you, and then we're going to get into a keynote talking about risks and opportunities of this new legislation. And afterwards, we'll have a little coffee break, and you're welcome to stick around, ask questions, do some networking, or head out before the heat really hits today. All right. So I'd like to welcome our two panelists up to the stage. Dr. Jean-Marie Mifsud is the Chief Innovation... Oh, I forgot it already. Why don't you come up on the stage, Jean? Let me turn on the mic for you.
Good morning.
Hi, and Ian Gauchi is from GTG Advocates. And we have a bunch of little questions for you today. We can probably all agree that last week's botched update from CrowdStrike is not something the Cyber Resilience Act could have stopped. Who here was impacted by the CrowdStrike? Was anybody traveling this weekend? I was. I missed a flight out of Frankfurt on Sunday, right? So these events have repercussions that go on for days. Do you think that CrowdStrike would have had to have done anything differently if the Cyber Resilience Act was here, Jean?
So if the Cyber Resilience Act was actually in force, then in that, from that aspect, the CrowdStrike would have been obliged to, first and foremost, disclose information in a timely manner and ensure that there is transparent communication. So that is one of the key elements of the CRA, informing the authorities, but also, most importantly, as equally important, informing the users. And there is a series of obligations in terms of how to disclose information. So certain informations need to be disclosed within 24 hours. Then there is an obligation related to different kind of reporting within 72 hours. And also, if necessary, they would need to submit a post-incident report within a month. So first things first, it will improve the transparency and the way information is communicated. And I would like to highlight that in this case, the incident was obvious. It was obvious that there was an incident because there was the blue screen of death. But what if we're talking of an incident that it isn't obvious? That the manufacturer or the responsible party is aware of, but the users aren't yet aware of. So maybe in this case, taking CrowdStrike as an example may look as counterintuitive. It's obvious that we know what happened. But what if we have a situation where it is not obvious what's going on, what's happening? And also, there's another element related to the CRA, which is the importance that is being paid to security by design and by default. Therefore, the approach that would have been adopted by CrowdStrike probably would have been slightly different in the sense that they are aware that if the way that they are processing their products during the entire life cycle, so not just during the design, not just during the development, but even after that, when it's implemented, upgrades, etc., they are obliged to take a certain approach that will minimize such incidents.
Ian, did you hear that Microsoft is now blaming Europe for this event with CrowdStrike because they were forced or obliged to make their operating system more available to third parties?
No, I quite honestly, this is a novelty, but it would not be something which I would totally discredit. I don't want to specifically discuss that here. I think Microsoft is well aware of the obligations. I think Microsoft benefits from the European market. So it has a very robust licensing regime, and I think it's quite profitable from their end. I think blaming it all on the European Union, it would be a little bit too much. Because even by blaming it, they're assuming as well responsibility for this particular tenant. So even there, we was discussing with Janine before, I think it's not clear who has direct responsibility and even in what pieces of legislation might kick in. But irrespective of the CRD, I mean, there are other legislations which come into play. So very blatantly and very simple, even GDPR, best technological measures should always be adopted, particularly if you're a controller. If you're not a controller, you need to have adequate as well mechanisms towards the process. Even there, the concept of stealth, cyber resilience, cyber secure by design, even though not directly mentioned, is still applicable. Depending on the areas of activity, and Microsoft would know because Microsoft would license the diverse areas of activity in diverse manners, okay, because they have different clusters of licensing, other obligations might kick in. So if it's used in the transport industry, you have NIS2, NIS1 and now NIS2, but even under NIS1, you already have the concept of vulnerability disclosure, you already have certain responsibilities, okay. You already have data breaches which stem as well from the GDPR. So even from that angle, that would be covered. You have the CRD, critical resilience, CED, critical entities, because we have so many nomenclatures that even I get confused. So even in that case, that even though this directive focuses directly on infrastructure, there is the cyber element as well, which is involved. I mean, there's a plethora of other directives which come into play depending in the particular areas of activity. In this case, I would say that certain legislation is already there and it's blatantly applicable. Now, whether Microsoft had the adequate governance model to modulate risk according to their licensing function and to make sure that the respective licensing bodies or collaborators at the end of the day meet the same sort of obligations back to back, that is another question altogether, because nobody ever imposed on Microsoft a particular governance framework given the risks at hand. I think the only legislation which is going to tackle that, and it will be up and coming, will be DORA. Okay, will be DORA. And under DORA, DORA covers specifically financial services. I hope I answered your question.
Yeah, it does. And I guess, you know, we're kind of in an interesting time right now because we know pretty certainly that the Cyber Resilience Act is going to enter force later this year. But Jean-Marie, what is the Cyber Resilience Act? And could you just tell us a little bit more about what it's going to require us to do?
So let's start from the background. Why did the European Commission decide or think that there's such a need? So devices that in some way or another collect data and process data are continuously increasing in our everyday to day use. Even if we look at our homes, we have smart everything, smart TVs, smart fridges, etc. All of these are in one way or another collecting some form of data. And maybe for you, it's not important, the kind of data they're collecting. Maybe for you, you wouldn't assume that a baby monitor is collecting important information. But the reality, there is a piece of information that comes from having a baby monitor. The basic level of information is whether there's a baby in the room or not, which would imply whether there is someone in the house or not. If you have a smart fridge and the smart fridge shows that the fridge is not really filled up, that could also imply that there isn't someone at home. So when we look at smart devices, although we label them as smart, but deep down we think of them as really dumb, they're not so dumb. They can expose certain information that you may not be aware of. So protecting these devices, I think it's important. And the goal of the Cyber Resilience Act is to set means, legislative means, how manufacturers, importers, and distributors know that they have certain obligations. And these obligations stem from security by design, as mentioned previously, and security by default. But then there's also the reporting obligations, and also the fact that if the device is not as per regulation, then there could be fines and you can also be asked by the relevant authorities to withdraw it from the market. So basically, on in all, one can say that it looked at the ecosystem, who could in one way or another be contributing to putting a device on the market, and assessed how they can ensure that the device is cyber secure to reduce the incidents. Now, there was another part of it.
Well, I mean, the follow-up is really, let's break down what a product with digital elements can be.
So, what is a product with digital elements? And I've already sort of hinted at it. We're talking here about a device, predominantly hardware device, but it could also be a software product. And it's important to emphasize the product. We're not talking of services here. We're talking of products. That in one way or another has some form of data processing solution, even if it is remote data, especially, I'm going to correct myself, remote data processing solution. Why is the remote important? Because when we're talking of remote data processing solution, it means that the device, the hardware or software product, is in one way or another connected to the internet. So it is not something that is completely disconnected from the rest of the network, and the only way how to have a breach is through a physical breach. This is something that can be breached across the remotely. And I also think that's important also to stress the part that we have data processing. So we have a device that is collecting some form of data. It is sensing. It could be sensing. It could be monitoring. For example, if we look at the CrowdStrike example with Falcon, what was Falcon monitoring? Falcon was monitoring the actual usage because it is an endpoint detection and response software application. So it is monitoring a lot of data, what the user is using. So it is a little bit, maybe one would appreciate that it is a little bit more risky than when we're talking of a smart fridge, when you are monitoring the load, how much food you have inside the fridge, the temperature, whether the fridge is working because it has a lot of food in it, load distribution, load uses, etc. So the point is, you have a device that in one way or another has data, it is processing that data, and it is connected remotely.
Perfect. But the Cyber Resilience Act, Ian, isn't really the only thing going on here, because my understanding is that it doesn't discuss liability in any way. That's why we have the Product Liability Directive, right?
Yes, it is a little bit fragmented. Let's start with the premise that you're going to have the Product Safety Act as well, which is going to be enhanced more to include more software products. Before, it was a little bit flimsy, pinpointing as a software, as a product. Now it's going to be clear. You have as well the AI Act, which is published. There, it's very clear, software, AI as a product, okay? You have AI liability, now directive, okay? So liability in this case is not directly covered. However, I mean, you still have civil redress, directions of tort, quasi-tort, and all the rest. But direct liability is not directly covered. And it will not be clear as well, okay, what particular elements, irrespective of the definition, irrespective of the annex, okay, will be deemed to be digital products. It's going to be extremely hard, particularly if you had systems already running, already in play. You have embedded software having the elements which Jean described, okay? And remember that processing is a very wide world. So processing even data. Okay, what data are we speaking about here? Because even personal data, it's always a moving goalpost. Always a moving goalpost. Even between lawyers, we don't agree what is personal data, what is no personal data. So let alone when you have all these intricate systems, elaborate systems, embedding these elements. And remember that here we have the interplay as well, even though, as Jean pointed out, there is the remote, but you have the interplay as well between hardware and software. And the remote element, if you have a virtual machine to a certain extent, whether you consider part hardware and software, I think it will become irrelevant. It will become irrelevant. So even the distinction, even though we have a new distinction in the law, I think for the normal user, for the normal deployer, it is irrelevant. within a complex mesh system. So there is going to be, I would say, a little bit problematic. And that's why, as we speak, the CRA has not been published. It is earmarked to be published in September, if I'm not mistaken. So it will have, I think, 10 to 20 days, and then it will kick in. There are transitory provisions and all the rest. But it will not be easy, because it has to interface with other existing legislation as well. You made reference to it. It is not the only legislation. We already regulate it. We're regulating IoT, Internet of Things here. Yeah. And it is Internet of Things. So there is this, and there's the Data Act as well, which will regulate Internet of Things specifically because of the data element. Well, even under the Data Act, if there is a risk of a particular compromise on the data within an IoT environment, you can, the legislator can even check the source code. This is the Data Act. Now, but we shouldn't forget that we have the Red Directive, which is a second iteration of the RTT. Both myself and Jean, coming from the telecoms world, know very well this directive. Now they have the Red Directive, Toys Directive. Okay, we have a directive which is very similar as well to the Cyber Resilience Act, which applies specifically to construction products. So even IoT within construction, but it is specifically within the construction industry, which is a complex industry when they use IoT, okay, is already covered by similar legislation. So AI Act, I mentioned the AI Act as well. You have as well DORA. If you use these digital products, a bank might use Python or an IoT in one of the digital products, and they have DORA. I mean, we already have a complex scenario between DORA, NIST to a certain extent because DORA is lex specialis, but DORA, AI Act, okay? Now we're going to add on top of that, okay, CRA, and it's not clear how they will interface. So I would say that we would need time to calibrate. We would need people to understand the extent of the regulatory capture, the extent of the obligation. At the end of the day, that part of extent, and it applies from the industry and from the regulator in equal proportion. There needs to be a proportionate approach. Proportionate, and we've discussed this several times. I think a proportionate and rationate approach. And I close with this. This ultimately, the difference from this and the AI Act is starking. Why? Under the AI Act, if you have AI which is already in the market, as long as that AI, okay, is not banned, because then it's outright forbidden, because it goes against fundamental human rights, which are already in play. But if it's high risk and it is already in the market, unless you do any modifications, it would not be captured by the AI Act. So the AI Act would not apply, even though if you're smart enough and you're in IT, if you are predicting an update, an upgrade or a modification, and you have an AI which is high risk, which is already to a certain extent, for example, biased. I mean, you, if I was advising my client, I would tell him, listen, take it off, do it, because then otherwise it can never be AI compliant. But the difference here is starking, because the difference with the CRA is, CRA you have, I believe, 36 months. After those 36 months with the problematic of defining exactly what this particular terminology is, depending on the complex structures, on the complex environment in a digital world. But after 36 months, you have to take it out. You have to take it out. So I am a little bit perplexed, to be honest. Maybe I lack the knowledge, I lack the expertise. We will see in these 36 months, but I think it's going to be problematic.
You know, I'm just going to tack on to that. I think a lot of the discussions around the Cyber Resilience Act treat products as finished things. What the regulator is talking about also is suggesting that components of products can also be considered something that has to be regulated by the Cyber Resilience Act. And not just the Cyber Resilience Act, as you mentioned, there's dozens of other acts, and while we might be hoping for harmonization, I think it is gonna be really complex. And then, you know, how do you think this is gonna really impact European innovation, Jean? Is it gonna stifle?
Well, the aim isn't to stifle innovation. So that's not from where the European Commission is starting. The aim actually is to increase the level of cybersecurity, to provide a better peace of mind, and with impact with the aim of reducing costs. And one may ask, how am I reducing costs if you are stipulating a number of obligations that I don't need to abide to right now? But one would reduce costs by eliminating or reducing incidents. And in this case, when we look at the incident that happened last Friday with Microsoft and CrowdStrike, so a simple mistake resulted in significant financial costs, but not just financial costs. I mean, there's also the fact that if you wanted to board your flight and couldn't, that's also a nuisance. So the aim isn't to stifle innovation, but to ensure that we increase the level of cybersecurity. And one would argue there's the element of the Brussels effect, that in reality, even though the European Commission comes up with a certain regulations that other non-EU nations are not obliging, mandating, once these obligations are enforced, companies tend to deploy them all across the globe, irrespective. They don't distinguish whether it's in the EU or outside of the EU. So yes, there may be some form of impact in the beginning, but in the long run, we should see benefits coming out of this rather than negative impact.
I mean, we know, for example, that Apple and Meta have both decided to hold back on delivering certain AI products to Europe because of their concerns about, I believe, the Digital Markets Act, or compliance with the AI Act specifically. I mean, we are already seeing this initial pushback from the giants, but I think there are other impulses, like what's happening in Japan right now, to start to see how Europe is managing the DMA in order to apply the same kind of regulations in Japan. So do you think that is the extended version of the Brussels effect?
Yes, it could be. In the sense that the European Commission is setting an example, and others are following suit, are following on that example. However, we must also appreciate that the European market is a significant market, so completely pulling out of a market such as the European Union may not necessarily be an option for even the big players. Deciding not to make everything available is one thing, pulling back is another thing. And I think it's a question of also testing, seeing how it will develop, and assessing business feasibility as well. So when it comes to these kind of decisions, yes, the European Commission is looking at the legal implications, although one has to highlight that these kind of regulations, before coming into force, even before actually proposing them, they usually carry out a cost-benefit analysis, an impact analysis to determine what would be the impact of such a regulation. All in all, the aim, at least the aim, isn't to have a negative impact and stifle innovation. One must also highlight as well that the European Union is putting a lot of efforts to supporting homegrown tech companies. So one could look at it from the perspective, if big tech slightly takes a step back, then homegrown small players, EU-based, could have an opportunity. So there's also that possibility, which when you look at it from afar, the level of innovation would still be high.
That makes a lot of sense. Okay, so Ian, you already mentioned before that we're expecting the act to enter force in September, and there's a couple other important dates there, right? There's the...
Before we go into the dates, because we mentioned the Brussels effect, and you mentioned manufacturers, and I think the largest chunk of the obligations is on manufacturers and importers. There's a shift as well, and there are developers who modify that particular software, that particular product, then the responsibility is on that. But let's not go on that. Brussels effect. I think here is where part of the problem will lie. Brussels effect, which applies for GDPR, which applies for the AI Act, would mean as well. So let's start from ground zero. We already have European companies who produce, who deploy, okay, who give to third countries, so not European countries, these digital products. And these digital products, as we said before, are used in a very wide array, are part of complex structures. This is the existing scenario. So right now, these companies have the Brussels effect with regards to GDPR, because it applies. But if they're not controllers, if they're not processors, okay, they merely work on a time and material basis. They produce the product, then the modulation of how data is processed and all the rest is up to the particular deployer. Then to a certain extent, they are just software developers, okay, product developers, nothing more. So even their GDPR applies minimally. They would need to apply security by design back to back for their produce, but other than that, minimally. But like with like scenario. So if you add now the CRA, with the CRA, there's the Brussels effect. With the CRA, these components, which were not regulated as components standalone before, will be regulated. Automatically, the 36 months kicks in. Brussels effect would mean that irrespective then, but even there, Brussels effect is augmented, is muscled up. Because Brussels effect would mean, aside from the fact that you have 36 months, and you have to see what you're going to do, and then it's easy putting on paper, you have to make it compliant. If you have a particular software which did not take into account legislative requirements which at that stage were not present, I mean, you will all teach me, sometimes it's practically impossible, as much as it's practically impossible if you have AI with data sets and you're telling the individual, if that data is not authorized by you, he should delete it. Be my guest, tell me how we're going to do it. Tell me how we're going to do it. So it's easy putting things on paper, it's easy putting things in the legislation, but then the practical side of it, at least let's say it's a gray area. I would rather say black, but let's say it's a gray area. Here it's going to be the same thing. Because these people now are affected with an augmented Brussels effect. So even though that product is not utilized in Europe, okay, is sold, licensed outside of Europe, so not utilized even by the respective user, there's still the Brussels effect. If the company is in Europe, it has to meet the requirements of CRA. So there, I think that the onus for Europe, for European companies, is huge. Because if I was advising a client, would tell me, listen, I will not touch Europe, but listen, consider opening up outside of Europe. Consider opening up outside of Europe. If you're targeting Asia, your main market is Asia. Your main market is not Europe. I mean, yes, potentially Asia might have the same, but time will tell. You're into this business. You know, time means money, okay? Sometimes even anticipating regulatory capture means money as well. It could be that you have a first mover advantage, but it's not so clear cut. So even there, I think that initially we will see certain companies moving out, particularly if their main market initially is not, or else if they don't move out, they segment their business. They leave a presence, and I think with stealth and intelligence, they would say, okay, this is for the European market, let's make a veil, let's build tailwind, and we make sure that we are leaders. But if we're targeting Mexico, if we're targeting countries outside, if we're targeting US, if we're targeting Japan, let's have R&D, let's have companies outside of Europe. That is the effect as well of the Brussels effect. And I wanted to highlight this because this is going to be now further amplified when the CRD comes into play. And I think we agree.
That's chilling. I had a couple of sort of formal questions, but I think we've kind of covered the spectrum of what we wanted to talk about today. And in light of us starting a little bit late, but also trying to stay on schedule, I'd love to offer the microphone to anyone here in the audience to ask a question if you have one. Now is your chance.
Hi, Robert Jones. So I come from a software world, but I also spend a little bit of time in Brussels, and this is about the Brussels effect. So if we look at all of this regulation, most of which you just mentioned, Ian, all the stuff that's coming through, it's been working its way through the system for, let's say, 10 years. But from some of the trips I've had to Brussels, and they're not the same as yours, and that's I'd like your feedback on, I'm hearing from people senior in the Commission and in the cyber sector and in the other sectors who are now starting to talk about, have we overdone this? Are we now shooting Europe in the foot? Because we're implementing things for good reasons that have unexpected consequences, which, as you were pointing out, Ian, people kind of going, well, I'm just going to set the business up overseas, so I don't have to worry about that problem. So it's just my experience is I'm starting to see and hear this, thankfully, to be honest, but I'm interested to see where this means we will be in 10 years. Will they be watering regulation down to actually fix their enthusiasm, shall we say?
Can I? So, a question to Ian. You mentioned that clients could segment their business to avoid these complications. Would you mean that if the client does not develop the product in Europe, they are not bound by that legislation?
Well, are you my client now if you're asking me for advice? Joking. No. If you have a particular client, and that particular client, its output will never be in the EU, nor will the use of that output to the person who sold it to him be in, because otherwise, respectively, if you're selling to X who is in Taiwan, but Taiwan wants to use it in Europe, logically, he will tell him, listen, it needs to comply with CRD. I mean, you don't need to be a rocket scientist. So if those two elements are absent, okay, and the market is predominantly non-EU, predominantly, and we're seeing that this will apply in 36 months, there is going to be a lifetime, they might be grandfathering provisions as well, it's going to be problematic. Yes, my advice would be move out. But if on the other hand, he wants to target you, has already European clients and all the rest, leave part here. It's only logical. People who are in the industry will tell you. Because this is not something clear-cut, RTSs will need to come out. If you have something clear-cut and you craft your strategy, you say, listen, yes, there's a cost, I want to be the first. If I lead, I know that initially I'm going to get a dip, but then otherwise we'll need to step up, we'll need to invest. First mover advantage I make. It's not going to be like that. It's not going, because it's still, it's, I think, would be pre-beta stage. So certain considerations will need to be made. Let me remind you, if you read the literature of the CRA, the Critical Resilience Act, CRAS, with so critical stuff, we get confused, even us lawyers. It has been always fraught with problematics. This one, you have as well the e-privacy regulation, which has not, I mean, we have been discussing the e-privacy regulation, which is the PECR, Privacy Directive, the PCR, which a lot of people don't even know that applies for cookies, for example, for consent and not GDPR. And it's a regulation. Now, there was to be a second iteration of the regulation. It's been in the pipeline for Robert, 5-6 years. 5-6 years, you might not have wasted your time on it. We've wasted a lot of time on it, and we have nothing. This particular act, I think, was forced. It was part of an agenda, as much as the AI Act was part of an agenda. I think we can speak candidly here. We have been following, I have been advising the MDIA and the AI Act from its inception, putting positions, asking for certain clarifications, putting Malta's position. I mean, the AI Act in the last month changed drastically, respective of what had been discussed, respective of all the policies, respective of all the exchanges. Last month was make it or break it, because France and Italy were pushing in a particular position. I mean, practically, take it or leave it. Correct or no? So, I think we were working on agendas. It could be that even with the AI Act, Europe has 2.8% of the total global market. We set a standard. Certain things are good. We set a standard. But there are risks. If you tell me there was an impact assessment, the impact assessment was on a previous version of the AI Act, which does not reflect. The impact assessment initially was not on generative AI, NLMs. There was no mention of LOPs. Okay, computing power, of output products. I mean, that came at a later stage. So things change. I think we have dished too much. It's going to be very difficult for regulators, because remember, as well, regulators. Here you can have the most severe regulators. If you bring the MFSA, for example, they are used to regulation. They regulate entities, but they've never regulated AI. They don't know how to anticipate. They don't know how to do market surveillance on AI. I'm mentioning because they could be as well regulators for AI under the Act. Same with MD. It's something new. New for everybody. Nobody has any particular legacy. Nobody has any books. It's going to be new. Same for this particular area. Same for the Data Act. Not speak Data Act. It's the same thing. Now, is it good? Is it bad? But I would not say, is it good? Is it bad? Does it make sense to have all these legislations? Does it make sense to have the need to create new authorities, new competencies, all at once, right now? I think that is the question which we should ask. Then a country like Malta, with our economy is a scale and economy of scope, I think we seriously need to reconsider our regulatory model. Can Malta afford to have a regulator for each respective industry, for each respective tenancy? I think I spoke with the Germans. They are struggling. Same with the Italians, they are struggling. I did not need to tell them that we are beyond struggling. Our economies of scale and scope are completely different. So even from that point of view, if we want to do things properly and not have boiler templating like we had before in the GDPR, okay? You're looking at authorities here, I work with these people. It's a hard task, preparing market intelligence to see exactly where, how, to apply then the element of proportionality, because that is on them, because it's no law totally regulating, but they need as well to nurture innovation locally. They need to make sure that people invest. So they need to understand, it's not an easy task, guys. They need to understand how to apply the measures proportionately. So I will stop here. Yes, however. If you have no operations in Europe and the end result will not be in Europe initially, we might have clients, I'll just tell them, listen, open up UK. UK is out of the EU. Or Isle of Man, it's out of the EU.
Okay. Thank you both for this amazing panel. I know, Jean, you have to get running. Ian, you're going to stick around a little bit. Let's give a little round of applause for our guests today. Right. Okay. So I'm going to be giving some perspectives of my own from the software industry, from the creator industry, and I hope that I don't offend you. I'm going to try to explain my perspective a little bit about software itself as a product, and I'm going to remind you that one of the hardest problems in software is naming things. I think if you're smiling, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And so we have this thing called cyber. Raise your hand here in the room if you know what cyber means. Yes, incredibly smart people in the audience here, nobody raised their hand. And I think the challenge of the word cyber is that it's not even a real word. I think if you look back in time, we can find the notion of cybernetics. I chose the Brit instead of the Russian, but both of them were involved in Cold War propaganda, and basically, both perspectives come down to this notion of a larger entity, right? Like, if you think about the cyber landscape, if we think back to what happened with CrowdStrike last week, we can see that, yes, okay, it might have been a mistake in the software coding or the testing or something, but it really impacted human lives. It impacted industries. It impacted hotels. Everything was impacted by this, and it kind of shows this notion of how everything is interconnected. And I want to kind of point that out at the beginning, because I think it's important to consider when you talk to the regulators, if you get the opportunity to, what they're going to tell you is that all of these acts, the dozens that Ian was talking about before, they exist to protect the most vulnerable, right? And that's us. That's us people. I mean, if your smart fridge, like Gene was talking about, if your smart fridge knows exactly when you're home and it leaks that information, then we are not protecting the human in the room. I think that, you know, that's the ultimate loftier goal of these regulations. And then let's talk about resilience for a moment. I mean, we have the Digital Operational Resilience Act, DORA. We have the Cyber Resilience Act. And I think, you know, there's a couple ways to look at resilience. If we looked at the resilience level of CrowdStrike, we would see, well, CrowdStrike might be something like a sheet of aluminum. It got smashed up, it had major impact all over the world, and now it's taking probably millions of human hours to repair the damage that was caused. And that kind of resilience is like flattening a sheet of aluminum after it's been crumpled up. I think the resilience that the commission is looking for is more like the resilience of an oak tree. Right? An oak tree or a mangrove, some kind of living entity, remember cybernetics, this living entity that's able to survive, to weather a storm, yeah? Return to its original shape. And I think that what the original shape, from the perspective of the regulator, should be is secure by design. It seems so obvious. I work in the security industry, I have for years. We build things with security in mind, and yet when the bottom line takes precedence over security, we have terrible events, and they happen all the time. I mean, I don't need to explain that to you. And the act, I mean, I'm talking about legislation here. I'm not talking about theater, although you could argue it is a bit of theater about what we're being put through, about the motions we're being asked to perform, but ultimately, governance by the Parliament, Council, and Commission are the various representatives of what it means to live in a democratic society. Maybe a somewhat of a social society, a society that's interconnected and cares for each other. And I think that, you know, without beating that drum too hard or too long, the facit is, from a very high level, we want to help each other, right? So I actually took some snippets from various parts of the documents about the CRA, and you know, if you recall what John said before, direct or indirect data connection. That is the bar that has to be met in order for something to be qualifying of protection or guardianship by the CRA. Cybersecurity by design over the entire life cycle of products. And I'll talk about this a little bit later, but I want you to remember that in software, a major feature is actually a new product, right? So if you release something that's more than just, you know, making the background color green, but maybe you add another type of interactivity to your existing product, you didn't. You just created a new product, right? It's the entire life cycle, and the minimum lifetime of your product is 5 years. Now, what Ian was talking about before, about, okay, where are we gonna be in 36 months? I think this is kind of interesting, because if you go fast forward to you know, September 2027, when the Cyber Resilience Act is in application, you're going at that point to be confronted with products that might no longer fit on the market. An example might be a wireless router that you cannot update. It's going to have to leave the market. But you might also have software that you need to keep on the market. So, like, this is not GDPR where you can just, you know, hire somebody to solve your problems. You are really going to have to start planning for eventualities that your software might become either obsolete, you're going to have to change it, or you're going to have to brick it. All three of those are big challenges for engineering teams that you're not going to solve in a couple months. And this is something I mentioned before while we were talking. The discussions right now are, on a high level, mostly about finished products. But if you build a component, if you build something like a software library that is used or sold, an SDK is a good example of this, that is used or sold by products that are in use in Europe, then you are going to have to certify that as well. I'll talk a little bit about the certification process in a minute, but that's the CE mark. I mean, if you look at the extension cord, the power plug, they're going to have these CE markings on. It's the Certificazione Europea, and that shows compliance with the regulations as described in the blue guide. If you haven't read it, totally read it. I'd really recommend it. It's linked pretty much everywhere where we've talked about this event, because the Cyber Resilience Act does not grossly modify the CE requirements or what a manufacturer is. Yeah. So we've been talking kind of around it, but here are the four big parts of what the Cyber Resilience Act is going to require. You know, your conformity assessment. For many cases, you can do it yourself. In some cases, you have to have a third party. We don't know who those third parties are, and they don't know what they have to certify yet. So this is a little bit of a waiting game, but you can get ready for it, and there are things you can do to prepare for collecting your evidence already. And you're going to have to keep it for 5 years per product, at least. Sometimes longer, depends on the life cycle of the product you're making. You're going to have to demonstrate, and I'm using particular words here, you're going to have to demonstrate secure software practices. I can tell you what I think they are, but the discussions that the regulator is going to be bringing probably is going to imply something else. And we just have to wait and see. And again, it's going to harmonize with, for example, GDPR. You know, just because you are compliant with the Cyber Resilience Act does not change your requirements of compliance with the GDPR, NIS2, DORA, AI Act, take your pick. So this is a really easy way to ask yourself, do I have to comply? Is there a data connection? Do you have a data connection? An external data connection? Is there an API here? Are you sending data across a network? If you answer yes, well, I guess it's time to buckle up. So I do want to talk about a couple opportunities. There's, I'm sure, many more to come. And then I'll talk about some risks and then give you some closing thoughts and time to ask some more questions. So secure by design is a product principle that considers the notion of the end user's experience, but also the stability of the system as priorities, right? So again, I hate to yell at CrowdStrike, I think everybody's doing that these days, but if we look at what happened there, they have a security product, but they botched an update, which means that some part of their delivery mechanism introduced a failure. And secure by design means that that kind of failure is logistically impossible to introduce. There's a number of methodologies to do this, and I'm sorry, ISO 9001 change management is just an excuse. It's not the same as really working on your internal policies and approaches and design paradigms for building software. Obviously, automation is great, but having a human in the loop to review things is more important. I mean, how many of you have interacted with an AI as a chatbot, for example, at the airline on Saturday when you can't get on the plane and it says, I'm sorry, I can't help you? That lack of a human in the loop is tragically bad, right? And I mean, for product people, you always have people in the loop, and one of those people should be your security team. So I talked a little bit about the CE marking and the blue guide. I think that this is really important knowledge to have if you're putting products on the market. It describes very, very plainly what a manufacturer is, a representative, an importer, a distributor, and end user or consumer. And that doesn't change. In fact, if you look in the blue guide, you'll see one section that talks about software. Ultimately, what the CRA is going to do is go more deeply into this data economy, this the usage and transmission of data, and the responsibilities of entities to do that. Now, we mentioned also what the CE does. It provides a seal of assurance that you are compliant with the regulations, and for 9 times out of 10, most SMEs, they can do it themselves. You can hire companies to help you file the paperwork, but you still have to maintain your documentation for a number of years. And I think at some point the CE will become a requirement. And you know, the Brussels effect of placing a CE mark on your software is also a unique selling point, or will be for some time. I'm not sure if it's like only the early adopters, but at some point, people are going to expect to see that marking somewhere, just like they expect to see SOC 2 or ISO 27001 or FedRAMP or GDPR or HIPAA or California Consumer Protection Act. You know, people are going to expect to see this because it shows that you are working to stay compliant.
CE marking is not new software. You have the medical devices to a certain extent. You have other directives, which the RTT had CE marking as well. Now we have the AIEC. The problematic part is CE marking on software, because then that CE marking, which leads to conformity assessment criteria being adhered to, needs to be through all the lifetime in a software. So that is extremely problematic, particularly if you're planning upgrades, updates, patches. Everything will need to fit in. If not, you will need to do the conformity assessment. So it's a headache. So, regrettably, people who write sometimes need to understand this extent. It has always been problematic. It's one thing having CE for a product, but it's another thing calling a software a product when that particular software is embedded within a larger scheme, and when they need to comply with CE marking, but it was already there. Now, conformity assessment is very similar to what we have under the AI Act. You have conformity assessment, which, humbly speaking, I think it's a joke. It's better if you don't introduce conformity assessment rather than give it. Let it be done by in-house people without even mandating that there needs to be impartiality, that at least it's someone who did not deal or has no interaction with the particular product, but they can be done in-house when it's not high risk, very similar to AI. But when it is high risk, or in certain categories, it needs to be done by conformity assessment body. So in that case, you need to interface, you need to get on board COBs. COBs usually will be attested by authorities for their particular competencies, for their particular remit, and they will assess whether your conformity assessment criteria, okay, are in line with the particular requirements at law, and they will give you the CE. In that case, that will be the CRA as well. I mean, it's part of the law. It's AI Act is the same thing. We're speaking about software predominantly, whether you call it product, sir, it's software.
You know, it's really, really true. It already happens. So friends of mine at the Eclipse Foundation, they run a project called THEA, which is an open source project using the Eclipse license. And they're using a product called Electron to build the back end of the application. It's a code editor. And their legal department requires them to verify that FFmpeg has not used GPL3 during the compilation period. And what this means is that their release schedule is now, at best, 1 month to 6 weeks after a critical patch has been made to, for example, Electron. And I think that, you know, when you start to consider the fact that the regulator is considering every feature, every version to be a new product, that means that your product lifecycle is absolutely going to change. And by the way, product lifecycles today are generally about 3 years. Now we have to maintain compliance evidence for 5 years, but that rolls on. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a couple slides.
To comply through all the lifetime of the product. It's very clear. So it's not that compliance is for five. You need to comply for all the lifetime of the product, but not only that, and there's a catch. Sometimes, particularly you have consumer legislation and all the rest, you might have a product with a life cycle of 6 years, 7 years. But then you stop issuing that product from that day. But you might have people under contract. So so even there, your obligations would be contractually, because the law does not say no, contractually, they might lead more than that particular life cycle, where in that case, you still need to comply, respectively, okay, with the CRA, with the AI Act, because if you are obliged to have conformity assessment, if you have obliged to have CE. But not only that, so let's say for the sake of argument, let me complicate it. There are products which already have CE markings, because there are. No. In comes the CRA, so it's not having a CE marking, you would need to update the CE marking because of new requirement, and you update them. You get a conformity assessment body, and you update them. Throughout the first year or second year, you have the CRA brings as well vulnerability assessment, which is very important. It's very similar to NIST. The particular importers, producers in that case, and distributors are obliged to make sure that they do vulnerability assessment. Regular audits, it can be through a CVDP, it can be through three TLP testers, to assess whether there is a vulnerability. So if there is a vulnerability, now this could be as well if there is something which is not functioning properly. There they will need to assess whether that vulnerability can, okay, forward-looking, be exploited, so be an exploit or not. And even here, how you calibrate that, depending on the exigencies. But let's say that they discover that that particular vulnerability can result in an exploit. This is intelligence. And this is mandated by law as well. So they decide, listen, we need to issue an immediate, not patch, upgrade. We need to advance certain updates which we had in the pipeline. Let's issue one upgrade and we'll cater for more. People who are in the industry understanding me. That might affect as well contractual obligations, because usually when you have a contract with a third party, they would need to pay more for those upgrades. But once you do it, if you're changing as well the parameters of your CE marking, conformity assessment, so the 5 years will still apply for those. If you do, you are obliged to do another one, in comes a second obligation from day one, from the new parameters, for the 5 years, because that data should be retained by the regulator. So the obligation of 5 years is pertinent to the data, to the respective conformity assessment.
5 years minimum, by the way. So, thank you. No, please join in anytime, Ian. And I guess this is the one that is closest to my heart. I've been working in open source software for decades, and there is a way for open source manufacturers, well, they're called stewards in the model of the Cyber Resilience Act. There is a way for these type of software creators to not have to comply with the entire regime of the CRA. Because they're not considered manufacturers, they also cannot place a CE certificate on their software because it's not a product. I think that is an opportunity for minimizing risk if you are a company that builds with open source software or you are building your own software. You don't have to donate it to a nonprofit, but you can claim, and again, this is going to be Ian.
If I may, this is one of the most trickiest part. FOSS. FOSS is exempt. Okay, is exempt. But It is exempt as long as it is not commercialized. As much as when you're licensing it, it is exempt from certain parameters. But if you commercialize it, then licensing requirements kick in. So we're not reinventing the wheel here. So from that ambit, if you just issue open source, simple force, no, but that would not be captured. But as much as you said before, you need to anticipate software development cycle, GDPR and all this, you need to see where that software is going to be used, even for liability now, with certain cases coming up and about. So in that case, if you anticipate that you are, because it's open source, it can be used, will be used, will be commercialized, will be an integral part of a digital element, digital product. So with all due respect, irrespective of what the law is saying, there, you'd need either to block any use, because you're going to leap it, but even that, I mean, from that, you need to literally amend the open source licensing criteria. It has to be very clear, okay? But if you don't do that, it will still be captured. It will still be captured,
yes, it will.
Because it will be part of the digital element.
If you're giving it away for free, it is. And I think that the challenge here that we're gonna recognize is, I mean, if you are doing software today, you are using somebody's open source software somewhere. And who is liable for that software, right? Like, I think that what we've seen over the past three decades of open source is that it's basically free real estate, and everyone who can use it is using it without paying for it, because why pay for something that's free? It's free and open source. However, once you start adding the thousands of Node modules, the hundreds of Go modules, the 50 Rust modules, the third-party modules that you're using into your product portfolio, that is going to change your actual risk exposure. Because if something happens in open source, it's your obligation to fix it for your product.
Very difficult for open source to be captured as a product. That open source within a digital component, a digital element, which then might attract, okay, certain requirements, for example, for certification. Certain requirements, as well as if you're going to do pen testing. If you're going to do a pen testing of that particular digital element, you would need access to that particular part of that element, which happens to be the open source software. I mean, there you need to have access rights respectively. So in that case, if the software forming part of the element is commercialized, the regulatory capture is very hard to avoid.
Right. I mean, if I place a commercial piece of open source software on the market and someone uses that in their product, then I would have to make sure that my product is still compliant and safe for them, which means I'm adopting their risk. I think this is a really important issue to consider when you're, you know, building software these days. I want to talk about a couple risks. I think I cherry-picked them. I think the biggest risk is non-compliance, because it not only can it be expensive, it could mean you are forced to take your product off the market, or you can't put it on the market, or until you have a cab that says, yes, you know, this passes the test, you can't put it on the market. So this is kind of expensive. I mean, if you can read this, it's 15 million or 2.5% of global turnover. And again, I think that we're going to have to wait to see how the regulator actually starts enforcing this kind of thing. But if it was CrowdStrike and as the Cyber Resilience Act was here, I'm sure they would shoot more for the 2.5% than the 15 million. Again, as a manufacturer of components, if you offer an SDK or a library to a third party, you are going to have to ensure that it works and follows the parts of the Cyber Resilience Act. And I think this is the nuanced part that you were bringing up, Ian, of, oh, okay, just move to Singapore or move to London. If you put out an SDK or a library, you're going to have to then make sure that it's never used in Europe, which as a member of the supply chain is really hard to guarantee, right? Right. So this is kind of a big risk, and I think, you know, similar to what Dora has taught us, is that if you are doing this and you provide this service to third parties and they're doing this kind of sale or usage in Europe, you might want to consider talking to your legal team to renegotiate terms, because it changes the impact of what you're going to be required to do in order to fulfill your obligation to your client and their users. And this is kind of the inverse of that, right? Like, other people in the supply chain might just not care. You might have a Singaporean company that is providing an SDK, and they're like, I don't care about Europe. I mean, we signed an agreement that you take on the responsibility. It's maybe buried in page 17 of the terms and conditions and the general service agreement that you signed. So that risk is something that you're also going to have to pay close attention to. And again, as much as I love open source software, the upstream dependencies are a huge issue. I don't know of any company other than Eclipse right now, and they're a foundation, that has actually investigated and audited every single component of every third-party library that they're using in their software. Now, there's rumors that Google does this, but they're not sharing, or Alphabet does this, but they're not sharing that information with the rest of us. So the risk is real and it's there, and if you're using open source, you probably have to dig deeper and make sure that you're safe. But again, that's a massive job. I mean, if you think about every open source library that my company uses, it's probably in the order of magnitude of about 5,000. At least 100 of them update every week. A dozen make major updates every month, which means that technically I have to have my security team working nonstop to audit every single line of code that's changed. Even that isn't enough. You have to audit it in use. So there's going to have to become a way in which we can ensure that open source is safe to use. I don't think the CRA really addresses that. It's going to be passing it on to us as manufacturers. And again, substantial modifications. We've been talking about this a lot in this discussion. Changing a feature is like building a new product, right? And that changes potentially the risk profile, which means that your assessment body has to go through it all over again, which means you have to plan for features months and months in advance in order to book time with them. And I don't know anyone here, have you had experience with delivering software on time? It can happen. It can happen. It can. It doesn't have to happen. There's a lot of risks we don't know about. And so what is going to end up happening is now software development is going to take longer. It's going to take longer to get your features not just built, but also approved.
In the act, there's a shift of responsibility. So if you're a manufacturer, you're an importer, and you have a digital element, digital component, as is, compliant, as it, we say, I'm a deployer. I want to use it in a particular system. Okay, I get your rights to do certain modifications. I modify. I take the responsibility of modifying. DCRA covers for that as well. There, this shift of responsibility, okay? Vulnerability assessment could be as well. We'll need to verify after this exercise. I'll verify. Could be as well compliance assessment. So in that case, there's a shift. The Act caters for that as well, caters for that shift of responsibility.
So the timeline, we've talked about it, just wanted to put this up here one more time. So in September of 2024, we're expecting the Act to enter force. Entering force basically means that it's been published in the journal and it's now law. However, you can't just turn the tables on everybody overnight like they did with the AI Act and give people a month. 20 days. Right, so after 20 days, then it actually becomes law. And we call this EIF, entering in force. Entering in force, that date plus 21 months is when you're going to have to start complying with the vulnerability reporting requirements of the Act. and 36 months after EIF, full compliance with everything, including the things that we don't even know that we have to comply with, right?
Has been inserted predominantly. It's a transitory provision for the digital components, digital elements that are already in the market to make them comply. So from that point of view, respective of the 36 months, because you might say it will apply after 36 months. No, that means that the time, your clock starts ticking 20 days after its publication. You have 36 months to either modify or withdraw. And in the same process, if you have contractual obligations, if you have, it depends if it's a consumer, if it's a user, if it's a business, you would need to modify those contractual obligations to cater for either the modified product, or in case you can't modify it because it's impossible to replace or to renounce to the client. So 36 months, which are critical for business, because we need to focus on business here, start ticking 20 days after the act is published. Vulnerability disclosure, it will apply, I believe, 20 months. But if you're already covered by NIS, then in that case, NIS will take over because vulnerability disclosure is already under NIS. But the important thing is on the 36 months for manufacturers and software developers.
So what we'd like to be able to help you with as a company, Crab Nebula, is helping you collect this evidence, because you're going to have to start doing it, retaining it for you, consulting with you and planning with you, again, with your legal team, potentially in collaboration with GTG, depends on, things. We love to help people understand security by design and road mapping and planning and the types of human resources that you're going to need, either internal or external for this. And as a matter of fact, we can also, for those of you listening on stream who aren't even in Europe, we can also support you as your official representative to the regulator as described in the blue guide. So I think we're pretty close to on time. I wanted to thank our partners and also, again, open the floor here for questions. But this time, Cheyenne, do we have any questions in the chat that have come up? Can I pass you the microphone?
Okay, so we have a question from Anthony who says, how do you determine that software is developed or used in the EU?
It's very easy. First and foremost, you need to see the intention. So if it's predominantly target for a European audience, okay, then the European market would be, to a certain extent, the first intent market for it. Then secondly, you need to prove it. So if that particular product is then meant to be used, is going to be used by European operators, European companies, it's penetrating the market, okay? If you also have, it is there available, and you know that you can't distinguish between European, American, Asian, might be an off-the-shelf, it's very difficult for a product, but let's say it's an off-the-shelf, then in that case, you need to predispose it as well, because you know that it will be available as well to the European market. There are no, for example, geofencing applications, so you cannot restrict the use in the European market, so unless you can do that, that will be the European market as well. So at the end of the day, this is a question, people who develop software, people who know who develop products here, because we're speaking about products, who know exactly how they're developing it, which for which market, and at a design stage, they would know exactly how to restrict certain use at the design stage. I think for them, this question might come relatively easy.
You know, I would also add that your company registration is a good indication that you might actually have to comply with these if you're in the software industry that is providing services to people. Then you're going to have to comply. How are they going to know? I mean, I think there's going to probably be mechanisms like GDPR where the end user, the human in the room, is able to lodge a complaint that says, well, my data got stolen and I'm European. And at that point, the regulatory oversight is going to dig in. I guess that's probably the wrong side of the fence.
Okay, we have a question from Valerie for Ian. Let's say the regulation has passed successfully. Do you think this will be keeping you busy? And will you be able to help us out on consulting small startups?
Yeah. I have to be honest, I don't think so. I think software people need to understand that they can't do everything themselves. As much as I might know how to code, but if I want to do a particular application, I rely on experts. As I consider myself a good lawyer, I know tax, but if I'm not a tax lawyer and I need a particular transaction where I need certain element of expertise, I would use a tax lawyer. This industry needs to understand, okay, that help might be needed in areas where expertise from your end, is not there. That's why you have lawyers. So until that gap is bridged, I would say no. And you see it from a lot of operators. We've seen it as well in GDPR. Lately, however, GDPR, we've started to see some sense, but usually software developers think that they can do things themselves. They just read paper, they just apply the metric from the paper. I think there is a total abyss from what an experienced lawyer, what an experienced professional, because it could be as well, an experienced professional, not a lawyer, okay, can do here to what the particular software developing guy or company can achieve, unless they have that particular expertise. So initially, until I think there is a sort of emancipation in this particular mentality, I don't think so, particularly in Malta.
Thank you. This is a question that was actually meant for Dr. John, but I think it's quite an interesting one maybe. Have you felt, either of you in your personal life, that any particular product or IoT must be regulated? This is a question from Noni. I have a 6-month-old at home and I still don't feel confident with the baby monitor, for instance. So how does this affect your personal life?
We have, where I live, a Ring doorbell. And we installed it because it felt easy to set up, it was comfortable, and then you read the news that Ring Company, which is a division of Amazon, I believe, is supporting law enforcement with evidence collection without my permission. Or, I mean, I guess it's mostly based in the US where they're doing that, but they could be doing it here. I don't know. I don't have insight into that. And I would prefer that the police come to where I live and say, hey, can you share any video that you might have recorded of this thing? Because I want that ownership over to my device. And I feel like in my personal life, I am renting technology. I don't own it. And that for me is this point in time where I have to trust the manufacturer to do the right thing, and I'm not sure that they are. That's maybe my perspective, Ian.
I hate repeating myself, but they're already regulated. If you have toys, there is the Toy Safety Directive. If you have product, the product needs to be safe. There's the GDPR component. Europe as well has, through the RED Directive, specifically amended parts, waiting for the Cyber Resilience Act as well, amended parts and amended the RTT to cater for these as well. So parts of them were already regulated. Then, I mean, aside from all this, as much as you have what voltages you can use, low voltage, they are regulated as well. There are CE markings, okay? So it's already regulated. To a certain extent, if the industry was mature enough and interpreted the GDPR, and this is the same thing we have in the AI Act, GDPR, the rights of the individuals, we don't even need these laws. Honestly, we don't even need these laws. The problem is that the industry, the market, the scenario is predominantly capitalistic. So when you have that capitalist ethos, most of the time, you tend to forget or put in a lower threshold the user, the interest of society as a whole. So that is why you imbue all these with legislation. But if that was not the case, we already have legislation which to a certain extent would cater for the scenario at hand. Not direct obligation. So now there is a larger risk because of this mentality, so people make, so in that case you need to balance things out, which is the aim, the same ethos why you have consumer legislation.
Could we take a couple more from the audience in the room, if there's any questions? Anyone? Yep, in the back.
So we mentioned that now every version of a software will qualify as a new product, and that will have implications on the release cycle. How will that affect A/B testing and canary deployments, for example?
Okay, I want to nuance the response. First of all, software security patches are applied to existing products. That does not trigger a new feature per se. If you're not careful with your release strategy, a feature might creep into a security patch, at which point you're gonna trigger this reset 5 years, let's have the cab come in and tell us if we're okay or not. And I guess the challenge of finding that sweet spot of A/B testing, of canary testing, I think there's a nuance that we can leverage here, and that is this is not a generally available product. This is something we're giving to our testers. I'll give you a great example of this. On iOS, we have something called Test Flight. I can give Test Flight to people in my company once Apple has signed off and said, okay, this is not gonna start your phone on fire. I can send it to the customer, for example, and they can test it out. I have not created a new product. It is not yet placed on the market. It is in that testing zone, and I would imagine that A/B testing would fall under a similar domain, because at some point you're gonna say, oh, it was the B test. However, in my experience, a lot of A/B testing is really about, do they like the button big on the bottom left, or is the background dark enough? Can they read what's going on here? Is this gonna fit our ally requirements? Is the internationalization working here? What about this little change in wording? Those are basically patch or minor level enhancements to an existing system. And what we're really talking about here is changing the risk profile of the product by introducing new features, which is what's going to trigger this being considered a new product.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else in the front?
Hi. We live in a country here in Malta where it's counterfeit products freely sold in the streets. There are illegal vapes all over Europe, illegal cigarettes, and a long list of other things that are counterfeit. So what makes you think that the CRA is actually going to do anything? In the sense that products coming in from Asia, there's a chip changed on the motherboard, it's got some new software in it. Who's going to find the problem? Who's going to be bothered with it? It's simply going to be a risk that everybody simply accepts and shrugs their shoulders with.
If I may say this, I don't think it's fair to, I think it's something which is predominant across the EU.
Yes.
I mean, we live here, so it's not only a problem about Malta, but something maybe that was not brought to light. So regulators are not slowly in each member states are being divested from the regulatory cap. As a matter of fact, before we used to call them NRAs. You have competition NRAs. Telecommunications, electronic NRAs, national regulatory authorities. That term is slowly fading away. Now, the regulator is a supra-regulator. It's made of different institutions at a European level. So in comes what we call a market surveillance authority. So a market surveillance authority with the stealth of intelligence, because they would need to know the market, the faculty as well to do impromptu spot checks, okay, assess the market. They can impose fines. They can as well stop certain, case in point, Italy data protection before the AIA came into play. they still stopped a particular AI product, okay, particular AI product, because for the Galant, the data protection authority, it was not safe, it was not compliant. So similar things will happen. CRA will have its own market surveillance authority. Its own market surveillance authority, as much as the AI Act will have its own market surveillance authority, okay? As much as financial services, the market surveillance authority is the MFSA. In telecoms, the MCA for radio equipment for the RTT is the market surveillance authority. So in that case, there will be a level of policing. There will be a level as well of sanitization and education. It comes part and parcel. You need to educate the people, so the people know their rights. You need to educate the industry, so the industry starts balancing things out and seeing as well prospect in investing in regulation and in embracing it. And you need to as well train these people to understand, to interface with these regulatory bodies. Because even now you're going to have rights of redress, you're going to have, if there's a vulnerability breach, certain rights which kick in, which are user-centric. It's all a cycle, it's not easy, but there will be a system which will be ingrained. Whether it's going to be successful, whether it's going to meet the initial intent of the regulator, then I honestly don't hold the crystal ball. But there is going to be a mechanism.
You know, it's kind of like saying, why did we regulate seatbelts? You know, like, oh, you don't need a seatbelt to ride in a car. In some places, it might be illegal to not have a seatbelt, not be wearing a seatbelt, but actually seatbelts have been proven to save lives. And I think that, and in my conversations that I've had personally with the people working on the Cyber Resilience Act and the Product Liability Directive, I just want to come back to this notion that the regulator wants to make life better for humans. That's the first and foremost goal that they have. And how many big cases have there been in product liability in Europe in the past decade? Thousands? Maybe?
Not that much, even because of the burden of proof, even that is going to change, okay? But there will be more. There will be more. And remember as well that this is a European system. Why this CE marking? Without a CE marking, you cannot penetrate, you cannot place, because the word used in the law is placing. You cannot place that particular product in Europe. So there will be as well something which came to the fore with this particular incident. There needs to be collaboration as much as Microsoft collaborate, as much as NIST will bring as well Cyclops. There will need to be there will be collaboration between authorities, because this is a border, even within Europe, it is a borderless environment. So to a certain extent, time will tell. Initially, till people grapple with these new concepts, till they impose their own organizational methods, but the ultimate result will be that they will have some leverage and control. That is why they crafted this legislation. Whether it's going to be fully applicable, particularly when we'll be speaking about software, that's another thing altogether. I don't know. I honestly don't know.
Okay, I think we'll take one last question, either in the room. Going once, twice, no. Okay, so we'll take one more question from the online stream, mm-hmm. And then we'll wrap it up.
I have a question from Nate. We are a small startup based in Malta and have offices in France. If we are going to hire a compliance expert to prepare for CRA, we are answerable to our investors. Will there be official guidelines from the EU?
Guidelines on compliance? Yes, absolutely. And I think that those are the parts of the CRA that are going to be developed over the next 12 to 14 months. But maybe, Ian, do you have a nuanced response?
There will definitely be more guidelines. I think even there are certain things which are unknown within the CRA, but other things, which I said before, basic principles are within industry practice. For example, if you look at ISO 27001, even if you're going for CRA, I mean, it's one of the first things I would advise a client of mine, at least. If you are not certified, make sure that you are compliant, because that gives you a good head start. If you don't have any governance model, see which governance model you're going to adopt so that at the end of the day, when the regulation hits you, you are prepared, you are prepared to modulate the requirements in your governance model. The CRA already has a lot of indications. There are as well, there's the impact assessment of the CRA. There are as well positions. There might be RTSs coming out, yes, but it will take some time. And I believe that the authorities in that case, let me remind you that there's no national authority as yet for the CRA. Even though we have the MDA as yet is not the national authority appointed for the CRA. So there's no market surveillance authority, at least officially, okay, who is mandated to take care of the CRA as yet, okay? Was not published as yet, so it will take some time. But there, I presume there will be some, yes, guidance. Something else which could be useful is, we've seen this in gaming, we've seen this in financial services, we've seen this in telecoms, they have GSME, GSMA. I mean, the industry needs to join forces, at least there needs to be a voice as a form of lobby, intelligence gathering, even sharing threats, sharing vulnerabilities, yes, keeping confidentiality, making sure that trade secrets are respected. But that form of intelligence, making your sound, your voice heard within this industry, particularly with regulators, who, as I said before, these regulators are not acquainted. Here we're regulating technology, cybersecurity, which has been defined only recently with the Cybersecurity Act. Is a technology. It is a security parameter, a security technology applicable to other technology. Then you have the options of resiliency and design, but it is a technology. So these regulators are not, there will be a learning cycle, okay, even for them. So if the industry has a voice, I think the industry can as well impact on that proportionality principle, on how the authorities perceive certain outcomes, and even they establish a relationship with an entity, which at the end of the day, before they did not have to, but now they have to live their life with them. So even from that front, I think the industry needs to be more forward-looking.
Yeah, I know that there's a group of foundations in Europe who are involved in manufacturing open source software that are working actively on collaborating with the regulator to specifically define the requirements that they have for their threat modeling, as well as the reporting requirements that open source software stewards are going to have to comply with. And I think that, you know, to maybe wrap up the official part of this conversation today, I think that it's important for us in the software industry in Europe to meet more often and talk about these things, especially with how they're starting to impact us. Maybe right now is kind of like the time for you to set your alarm clock. Let's get back in touch the beginning of September when the CRA hits, and then you need somebody to talk to. And I think that setting up a trade organization, or perhaps even within the Malta Chamber, could be a great opportunity for us to grow that community and keep on having these kinds of discussions. So with that, I would love to thank Ian and John and our tech crew here and all of you for joining us today. And feel free to stick around and chat, or have a cup of coffee or orange juice with us before we send you all off in the heat of Europe. Thank you.